Progressive News. I think I can hit the space bar. Yeah, that'll work.
Welcome to CU Progressive News, bringing you the many voices of your community. This show is produced in the studio of WEFT 90.1 FM at 113 North Market Street in beautiful, vibrant downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Prairie Air Incorporated, UCIMC, UPTV, WRFU, any board of directors or staff of those organizations. This program is a collaborative effort. Please email weft90.1@gmail.com with your program ideas to get information on being trained to be a citizen reporter or to be a WEFT host. We are indebted to WEFT and its members for currently and for 35 years providing the infrastructure for independent media. We are indebted to the public eye, WRFU, UCIMC, and UPTV for their collaborative efforts. This show in whole and in segments is available as a podcast through SoundCloud, iTunes, or your favorite podcatcher, and is also distributed through the WEFT Facebook page. This week on CU Progressive News, Sandra speaks with Lakeisha David of the African Kinship Reunion. Sandra then will update us on three local current event items, and Ben Mueller responds to a December 26th op-ed article that ran in the News Gazette pertaining to Urbana declaring itself a sanctuary city. So first, here is Sandra with Lakeisha David.
So, I'm speaking with Lakeisha David. Lakeisha, you're a member of the Champaign-Urbana community. You're a graduate student, and what are you studying? You're getting a doctorate in what?
Human development and family studies.
Great. And you have, you're the founder of an organization, a not-for-profit organization called TAKIR. Tell us what that stands for.
TAKIR stands for the African Kinship Reunion.
So you, basically the gist of it is that you have a DNA matching system for people who have, who are descendants of the slave trade, perhaps, and matching them with their relatives over in Africa, or trying to make that connection for them. Is that right?
Sort of. So, the mission is to reunite African families who were separated by the transatlantic slave trade, as well as a few other things. We use the ancestry DNA database. So, we would encourage applicants to take the test, but we're using the ancestry DNA test kit, mm-hmm. and then we'll send it to them, and they will do the process, and we'll look at the results, and then help people to identify their relatives.
Are you doing most of the encouragement of this from the United States or from Africa?
Both. So
okay.
a lot of
okay.
it, it started out, well, you know, like it's more convenient to encourage people in the U.S. as far as shipping the kits and things like that. But I also have a relationship with Ghana. And so while I'm there, I take kits with me and test a few people from Ghana too.
So the DNA test kits that you're using, when you're saying they're ancestry DNA test kits, are they from like ancestry.com, that organization, mm-hmm. or any, yes?
Mm-hmm. Ancestry.com. And they call the product itself ancestry DNA.
I gotcha. And that has the test kits and the database. So they have the database that's being used.
Right.
I guess the thing that I would suspect is that the more robust it is, the more people are using it, the more results you're going to get, right?
Yeah, and so because I'm using ancestry DNA, that sort of speaks to that. So they've tested, I forget how many, but you know, it's over a million DNA profiles in their database right now. Because of that large database, when in say a person from Ghana will take the test, they will find, they tend to find maybe like 100, 200 relatives, like ranging in closeness of relatedness.
How closely related? How close do you generally get?
It depends. So it depends from the coast of Ghana, They tend to come in as high as a fourth cousin level, which will be equivalent to about like sharing a fourth great grandparent. If they're coming from the inward area, like closer to the border with Burkina Faso, then it's a little bit more distant, maybe like the fifth to eighth cousin level.
Mm-hmm. And so are you focusing on Ghana because you have a personal relationship with someone there, or because you have ancestors there, or because a lot of slaves came from there?
I am focusing on Ghana mostly because of my relationship there and because of the history of African Americans with Ghana. So when the first president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, took office, he said that Africa, you know, like, he invited African Americans to return to Africa through Ghana. So, like, Ghana would be, like, the gateway to Africa. And so, so we have, like, this long relationship. Yes, millions of Africans were taken and routed through Ghana, but also thousands returned to Ghana through the 1960s. So I'm focused on that to sort of follow that story.
So tell me again, so people returned to Ghana through the, what did you say?
Well, so in the 60s, when Kwame Nkrumah invited African Americans there, so many people just went, not because of DNA testing, but because of our ancestral history with Africa in general. So thousands of professionals, skilled folks went over and relocated.
Hmm. So I wasn't aware of that. So there was a movement because the president of Ghana invited African Americans or Africans, people of African descent, I guess, from wherever they were, or maybe primarily America, to return there with some kind of offer or what?
It was mostly to help them to build up the country. So, you know, it was right when they gained independence. And Kwame Nkrumah also went to a university here in the U.S. So I guess he, you know, established some relationship while he was here.
And so have you made a trip to Ghana.
Uh-huh.
And what was your experience like?
Wow, that's a really big question. But I'll narrow it to the experience with stuck here. And that is that when I talk with people about possible, you know, possibly being related to people in the diaspora, people are generally open to talking about it, you know, and they are somewhat open to doing the DNA testing. So that's exciting.
Mm-hmm. So is there any downside of it? What are the arguments against it? What do you hear, any negativity about it, about DNA testing?
Okay, well, let me start with the positives.
Okay.
So there is a human need for continuity, you know, to have that narrative, to have that story. When people, you know, engage in genealogy, it is, you know, some of the reason, you know, it's partly because of this quest for continuity, you know, identity, who am I, to be able to answer those questions. And so for African Americans, you know, our story was somewhat disconnected because of the nature of slavery, which was to remove all of our knowledge about where we came from, language, practices, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the African American narrative tended to be there was no possible way of us really knowing about where we came from other than this general place called Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So with the DNA testing, we are able to find not only ethnic groups where we came from, which were millions of people, some of them, we're able to find the family clans. We're able to find like families where we're sharing a fourth great grandparent, and people that we can develop a relationship with because of the familiar ties who can tell us about our own history, you know. So there's a lot of healing that takes place because of these reunions. There's a lot of hope and expectations that increase because of this. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we're using this DNA testing to find our families. No one can speak against that, regardless of what the, you know, negativity may be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the downside, I think the biggest downside that's my concern is security around DNA testing in general.
Mm-hmm.
How secure is it, you know? The idea of biological warfare and things like that. It's a serious matter.
Well, tell me about that, and what do you mean biological warfare?
Well, there's this idea that people can take their DNA and make specialized weapons that's targeted towards people of a certain ethnic group. And so that's one, you know, that's one thing, one fear. And then there's other things that's really not really related, but the idea that other people, like, who are not of African descent, will look at these DNA tests and say, try to quantify race, mm-hmm. or try to give favor because of a certain percentage of ethnicity. You know, so, like, if you have, like, 80% of African ancestry, then you can no longer get this benefit, or, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like that. So that's that issue, but again, these are people who are finding their own family. Mm-hmm. And regardless of how someone else abused it, you know, that's not to say that we shouldn't continue on this way. We just need to be aware of those issues and then address them.
That makes sense. Can you tell us about anybody who has been reunited due to your program?
Oh, yes. All right. So, I have a friend named Rhoda, and she's Ghanaian. She's Fonte from the coastal area of Ghana. She took the test. I should have said that she was a skeptic at first, you know, mm-hmm. so I'm really proud that she eventually took the test. And she took the test, her mother took the test, and her maternal grandmother took the test. She found that she was related to an African-American named Eileen. And Eileen and Rhoda have, you know, spoke. I don't know if it's like they communicated through email or by Skype or somehow, but so Eileen, the African American, is related to all three on Rhoda's side. But I think that's one that's more exciting than that is that Rhoda, to all three, Rhoda, her mother, her grandmother, is also related to Melvin. And he's African-American as well. He recently traveled to Ghana to meet his family, you know, face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and so him and a few, you know, his colleagues or whatever, went to Accra, met his family there, traveled to Amina, met another part of the family there, you know, and just engaged in all these family-building type activities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the range of it, from, you know, just talking on the phone and Skype to actually, you know, traveling and seeing each other face to face.
How did you get to have a passion for this?
Well, it's my own story too.
Mm-hmm.
It's my own story, and it's something that my mom sort of gave me. She instilled in us a pride in our African ancestry when we were growing up. But then when I was in grad school at MIT, that pressure, that time was a lot of great pressure. I sort of drew on those core issues. And so that took me back to identity and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I was graduating from my master's degree, and so the next step, you know, was to be able to do research, and I wanted to research this.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah, it seems like a, you know, very worthwhile and fruitful project. How much does it cost to use Ancestry, an Ancestry kit?
It's about $108. Including shipping and handling. We have a lot of sales, though. And where the cost might, I don't know, that's another sort of critique is the cost. But, you know, I do remind testers is that those results to share it with the family. You know, so in the case of Melvin, you know, he tested, he found out he was related to Rhoda and her grandmother. You know, but that's not just his results. That's, you know, all the people that in his family, hundreds, I guess, that share that same ancestry.
Right, right. Is there any additional cost to, besides the kit, that that people would bear if they work through your organization?
No.
No? And accept donations? And what do you, if so, what do you do with those donations? I know you're a 501c3, so.
Yes, we are fiscally sponsored by the CUIMC.
Mm-hmm.
And so we collect donations through them. And up until this point, the bulk of it has been towards buying the kits for Africans, mm-hmm. for first-generation Africans. There was a small amount for an event that we hosted at the Arizona Burnaby Library recently. It was in October. And where we had, we were invited relatives to come and to share their story with the community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those are the costs at the moment, the tests and an event.
Mm-hmm. So people who wanted to make a donation, how could they, should they go to your website? Is there a donate way to donate through there?
Yeah, so takir.org, takir.org, and then there's a link there, something like donate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's PayPal option, and then the option to mail a check, if that's more convenient.
Great, great. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to say before we go?
Wow, thank you for allowing me to share our story, you know.
It's exciting. Yeah. Well, I'm glad to be able to, and thank you for doing it. And I do want to ask, how long have you been doing it? So how long has TechCure been in existence?
This is March, 2016, so it's this year for the organization. Yeah, but as far as the search, that's been many years.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay, well, thank you for speaking with me today, and I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Sandra Otten with CU Progress News. The Champaign County Board is deciding whether or not to put a referendum on the April ballot asking for a tax to support the county nursing home. The funding of the nursing home was included in the facilities tax referendum that was soundly defeated during the November elections. It's expected that the county board will be meeting on January 10th to discuss this matter after the committees of the whole meeting. I called the county, though I couldn't confirm that this date had been set. According to the discussion at the last county board meeting, it would not be able to wait until the next regularly scheduled county board meeting, which is on January 19th. So we'll keep you updated on when that firm date happens and then on the results of that discussion. This is an issue that is of particular interest to many progressives because of a couple of reasons. First, there's the belief that we need to be able to find a way to keep the nursing home open, despite the fact that it has management problems in the past, in order to take care of the most vulnerable of our citizens. Second was the difficulty that progressives had in deciding not to support the failed facilities tax referendum, knowing that the nursing home may suffer because of the non-support, but feeling that it was important not to support the facilities tax because of how much of that tax would have been used to fund the expansion of the county jail. We have been regularly reporting on the status of the contract for the Service Workers Union at the University of Illinois, that is, the union known as SEIU. The workers are, in essence, being asked to take a pay cut as their health insurance benefit it's going to cost them twice as much as it does now. That benefit is not something that they can negotiate. That is negotiated directly between Rauner and another union called AskSME. We have also been reporting that the U of I has declared SEIU and themselves to be at an impasse, which is why they're now using a mediator. According to Ricky Baldwin, their representative, they will be sitting down with a mediator and the university officials on January 9th. We'll be following up on that story at that time. If you have other labor or union news, please let us know at weft90.1@gmail.com. We are also preparing a story on the Women's March in Washington, which will take place on the day after the Trump inauguration, January 20th. There are two buses from Champaign going, and you can find information on how to be on one of those buses by going to rallybus.net. That's RallyBus.net. There you would just type in the Women's March on Washington and then Illinois and Champaign, and you will find the details on that. There's also a bus going from Champaign to a parallel rally that's being held in Chicago. And the details on that can be found by looking up Julie Pride, one of the organizers on Facebook, and looking at her events. That's Julie Pride, P-R-Y-D-E. If you're going to either of these events, we want to ask you three questions. Why are you going? What do you hope it accomplishes? And what are your reservations? We're going to do many five-minute interviews and tie those all together in a future show of CU Progressive News. So if you are going to one of those events, email us, weft90.1@gmail.com.
This is Sandra Auten with CU Progressive News reporting on the state of the Times shelter, the men's emergency shelter in downtown Champaign that has been shut down since about June or July. As you know, probably the background on this is that the organization Rosecrans owns the building. They used to be Community Elements, and they decided to shut down the building and not operate a men's emergency winter shelter there. So I wanted to state these facts. This fact, we have no men's emergency winter shelter. Another fact, there's a group that includes volunteer organizations, churches, and United Way working on a solution that will involve a shelter at multiple churches, B, raising funds through private donations to staff the church centers, B, transportation of men to centers through volunteer coordination and efforts, and that will likely go into effect very soon in January. But there are ongoing complications that are going to happen because of the fact that there are volunteer churches and volunteers doing the transporting. Just the whole how to do any kind of ongoing funding with it. Another fact, the perfect location and building sets nearly empty. That is the Times Center. The best plan that they have come up with will fall short of a plan that involves locating the center at 70 East Columbia in Champaign. This building is not being used to capacity. It's being used for a 20-bed men's transitional program. You can drop by there and see that for yourself. Fact, the building was paid for using intergovernmental cooperation and private funds, including funds from your city if you live in Urbana and Champaign, or your county if you live in Champaign County. That totaled more than $1.4 million back in 2000. Fact, Rosecrans owns the building and they have no legal obligation to rent, lease, or give the building to the group that's trying to get the emergency shelter off the ground or to run it themselves. They do not have any legal obligation to do that. But they do have an ethical responsibility to do so. And I believe the constituents who have signed a petition of over 1,500 people asking that our city and county governments try to negotiate that with Rosecrans. Another fact, Sheila Ferguson, the director of Rosecrans, says herself in the News Gazette that over the years they've accumulated a debt of $260,000 while running the shelter. That is a startlingly small amount of loss over the many years to run such a vital service for our community. Rosecrans, Community Elements, did not approach the governmental agencies and say, you are about to lose your $1.4 million investment unless you come up with X amount of dollars to fund us. This questions need to be asked of Rosecrans. They need to be asked, how much money would it take to have the building at 70 East Columbia Street used for a men's emergency shelter? Each of our current governments funds Rosecrans services. If they indeed flatly and outright deny the use of this building for its intended purposes while men freeze on their doorsteps, then that is something that we need to know about Rosecrans as they further entrench themselves in our system of care for the poor, the addicted, and the mentally ill in our community. We understand there are nuances, such as the fact that Rosecrans may want to, in the future, use that building for drug and alcohol rehab or offices for their current services. We understand they may want to build a much-needed detox center in our community. This is all the more reason to hold them accountable for this action of depriving our community of the use of this building right now. It's nearly empty, it's available, and they literally hold the keys to most easily solving this program. This problem. Rosecrans will undoubtedly be asking for more public and private funds from our community in this future for services that Ms. Ferguson says are their core competency, that is mental health and substance abuse disorders. As a community, before we fund them, we need to know that they will make the decisions that are in the best interest of our community. Fact, we are not asking them to take a loss. We are asking them, what would it take to make this building available for a men's emergency shelter immediately? Time is of the essence. And I am proposing, me, Sandra Auten, am proposing that the city councils and the county government send this letter to Ms. Ferguson of Rosecrans on behalf of blank, the City of Champaign, City of Urbana, County of Champaign, County Mental Health Center. I'm asking that Rosecrans reassess the denial of the Time Center located at 70 East Washington Street in Champaign to be used as a men's emergency shelter. Together with other local governmental bodies involved, we need to know the cost that would be involved for Rosecrans to reopen the center or to rent or lease the building to another agency to operate the center. That's the message that I, Sandra Auten, am delivering with a petition signed by 1,500 people, many of them probably listening to this right now. And it's going to be delivered to the City of Champaign on January 3rd at their council meeting, January 9th at the Urbana Council meeting, and at the next county board meeting, which will be on the second Thursday, I believe. I do want to update you that the United Way and others are doing amazing work in trying to get a men's emergency shelter off the ground. They are making progress and may have that open as early as January 6th with two different locations, the First Presbyterian Church Sunday through Thursday, and then Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign on Friday and Saturday. That is until they can find some place that could possibly give them a facility 7 days a week. Salvation Army is out. That space needs modifications, and Salvation Army does not have the ability to reopen their space. They have a budget, this group that includes the United Way, of $30,000 to $40,000, depending on the rent, for 3 months of service. That's what they're trying to go for, and they think they're going to be able to get that amount together and pay that rent and be able to pay their staff of four people while they are running this emergency shelter for 3 months. They have $18,000 solid in donations, plus what the United Way is given, and then there's other donations that are coming in as well. And I do urge you to make a donation to the United Way to further fund that shelter. That's a great thing. But if the Time Center would open up, just think of the simplicity that would be involved instead of shuttling people to different locations, a central location that is available for the men to get themselves to. It's very accessible. Would be such a better solution, and I am urging that the city councils and the county board at least ask what would the cost be to reclaim that building for a short period of time at least, if not permanently.
Up next, we have Ben Mueller's thoughts regarding an op-ed piece from December 26th News Gazette. Ben is a longtime immigration reform activist and former WEFT host with the show Nuevos Horizontes. The op-ed piece Ben is responding to is called No Sanctuary from Reality, Urbana is Back in the Business of Moral Posturing, and it criticizes the Urbana City Council's December 19th decision to pass a resolution declaring and reaffirming the city's position as a sanctuary city for the immigrant community.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you, Brian, for this opportunity to respond to the op-ed piece in the News Gazette that was published on this last Monday, basically condemning and, I think, some ways harshly criticizing the sanctuary resolution that was passed by the Urbana City Council in their recent meeting on December 19th. I'd like to clarify some things about the resolution as a start, and then I'd like to continue on to read a statement or to paraphrase a statement I have in response to that op-ed article in the News Gazette. I want to point out that the resolution, and this may be, there may have been some slight changes in this, but basically the resolution states that whereas this is resolution 2016-12-070R. This resolution basically, I'm not sure if this is the final form, but basically the language is very similar to what I'm about to tell you. Whereas while recognizing the fact that undocumented immigrants who are in the United States have committed a violation of immigration law, we judge the human, moral, and practical negative costs and actual evils of deportation or other major sanctions against undocumented residents of our community and country to far outweigh the legal circumstances of their arrival and continued residence. And then there are several provisions that are important, one being that no city employee or official or department or agency of the city of Urbana shall request information about or otherwise investigate or assist in the investigation of the citizenship or immigration status of any person unless such inquiry or investigation is required by a court order. Notwithstanding this resolution, the city attorney may investigate and inquire about citizen or immigration status when relevant to potential or actual litigation of an administrative proceeding in which the city is or may be a party. The second major provision is that no city employee or official or department or agency of the city of Urbana shall condition the provision of city benefits, opportunities, or services on matters related to citizenship or immigrated status unless required to do so by state, federal law, or by a court order. So I think what's important to know about this resolution is in conflict to what was said in this op-ed article. This is a resolution. This is not a law. This is something that supports the following, that neither the city nor its agents, including the Urbana Police Department, can ask people to disclose their immigration status with limited exceptions. And those kinds of exceptions would be when there's a warrant for someone's arrest, when the person has, committed a felony or a serious crime. And then, of course, there's going to be cooperation. And secondly, neither the city nor its agents can divide benefits or services on the basis of immigration status unless required by state or federal law. So it's important to keep in mind that sanctuary status, despite the use of the term, does not mean that undocumented immigrants are beyond the reach of immigration authorities within Urbana city limits, which entirely contradicts one of the major points of this op-ed article. This resolution aims to govern the policy and conduct of city officials and employees, as well as to reaffirm the city's commitment to welcome immigrants. Okay, so I think that there's some a good deal of confusion and mislabeling in this op-ed article. And so, as I pointed out, there's one, probably the first implication of the author of this article is that this resolution was passed by and supported only by city council members and a room full of supporters at the meeting. In fact, the concepts of the resolution to defend human rights and respond to the requests from immigrant communities to defend them against crimes is widely supported by public officials and leaders across Urbana as well as Champaign. And I would include in those leaders the superintendents of both school districts, the Champaign County Sheriff's Office, and the city police chiefs of both communities, leaders from the faith community, and many others. Recently, the CU Immigration Forum held a meeting at the Champaign Public Library where there was an overflow audience of nearly 250 people who voiced their support for immigrants and their families. Secondly, as I said, this is a resolution and it acknowledges that there are some limitations to this resolution that would be overruled by a federal and state law. So to try to say that that this is some outlaw effort on the part of the Champaign, Urbana City Council, and only supported by city council members is wrong-headed and misleading, to say the least. There is a point here also that we need to begin to consider is that, you know, this whole idea of what is proposed in this resolution. Actually, our Constitution supports the rights of the people residing in our country to have their rights protected. And so it's our responsibility in our communities to uphold those rights out of respect to our Constitution. To not support immigrants who reside in Urbana would also make the job of law enforcement officers extremely difficult, because if we are not supporting them, then it will make that more difficult for them to come forward and report to the police about infractions of the law where they have been victimized, or they are aware of other crimes that have occurred, but out of fear that they can't come forward and cooperate with law enforcement. That's why our law enforcement officers and their leadership are so supportive of this resolution. Also, it's really important, I think, that we recognize that there are responsibility of city government officials to defend the rights of those that reside in Urbana and in our communities. Those types of rights that need to be defended may be related to unfair or illegal employment practices, a whole variety of issues and topics that it is the responsibility of these officials to support those that reside in our community. So it's extremely important that these officials in Urbana have the support of those that are not documented, so they feel free to come forward and lodge the complaints and the problems that they are facing in our communities. Secondly, you know, I strongly object to the term illegal immigrant, the terminology that was used over and over in this article, and for anyone that speaks about illegal immigrants. I'd just like to step back a bit and try to say, you know, who are illegal immigrants? In the terminology of this article and how it's written, you know, I would have to say that, you know, all of us are illegal immigrants. All of us are descendants from immigrants who streamed, you know, across from Ellis Island in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty. All of us were illegal. Our founding fathers and mothers, the Pilgrims, the Irish, the Germans, the Poles from Europe, all those fleeing religious and political persecution, or do any of those persons, when they came to the first step of entering our country without documents, without papers, many of them without being able to even to write or have very little documentation to support their rights to residency in our country. We didn't turn them back, and we didn't turn them away, and that's what our nation has been built upon. So I think that this is a very false analogy. And secondly, you know, I want to be clear that, you know, in recent history, you know, persons that have illegally entered our country with criminal records or who have committed felonies while they're here, you know, they have been actively pursued over the last 8 years and before that. You know, the Obama administration has deported over 2.5 million of these individuals. And so there is, it's not a question of, you know, we have to separate, you know, those that are actively committing crimes or entered our country as criminals from the vast majority of the 11 million persons that are here are hardworking people who have come to this country for a variety of reasons. So, you know, and I like to also separate further the dreamers, the 700,000 dreamers who were brought here by their parents and who are students and hardworking and taxpaying employees, and many of them have started businesses or are professionals. They cannot be categorized in the same breath as people, the very small number of people who have entered our country illegally as criminals or who have committed a serious felony-level criminals while in our country. So these 11 million people living here peacefully, contributing to our economies, somehow there's this implication that unions are responsible, or that someone is responsible, or that these persons just came here you know, on a whim. The truth of the matter is that this immigration stream of persons, particularly south of our border, has a long history. It has a long history because there are sectors of our country that cannot survive without these persons helping them pick the fruits that are so important to our economy. And, you know, beyond that, the service industry. You know, why do we hold unions responsible? These are non-unionized jobs. We cannot fill the demand for the backroom kitchen workers, the hotel maids. These persons are important to our economy, and they are filling a job that other parts of our population simply do not find attractive for the wages that are offered. So I think that we need to take into account that all of us in this country and our very economy share in the responsibility for these persons coming to our country and working here. And to penalize them it would be, I think, unjust and inappropriate. So, you know, the one thing that I do agree upon in the article is that there needs to be a reformation of the immigration laws. But I think that businesses have to join forces with the families that are here and have relationships with these persons in order to reshape the immigration reform policy. I would have to call back to the last important immigration reform that was led by, you know, a conservative Republican icon, you know, President Reagan. So, you know, we really haven't had too much significant immigration reform, despite the efforts, the bipartisan efforts, of leaders of Congress and the House of Representatives to have a substantive immigration reform law brought into place in our country. So we definitely do need to do something about immigration reform. And that I agree. But the approach that is suggested in the article, I think, is a recipe for disaster. And why do I think that? Because suppose we begin to think about trying to deport, you know, the millions of young people who were born and raised in this country as the children of undocumented parents. Our new Attorney General is someone that has been on record as even attacking the legality of those children who were born in our country and at 18 years of age would become legal citizens. And then you start thinking about, as I mentioned, all those hundreds of thousands of people who have the DACA status, you know, as young people who have been brought here by their parents and have, you know, gone through the education and the requirements in order to be receiving work permits and social security numbers and are active members of our country and our community here in Champaign-Urbana. I think that then we look at the mere act of trying to deport millions of people that don't fall in these categories. This is a recipe for disaster. This is going to be something that would tie up our courts. This would be a human rights catastrophic event that I would agree will not be tolerated by responsible citizens from all walks of life in our country. I'd also like to remind the writer of this op-ed that if we looked at the private sector, a key factor for success of companies in our country has been shown to be diversity. Our nation is built on diversity and the respect for the rights of all who reside within our shores. To try to tear apart this fastest growing minority Hispanic population in the U.S. is a recipe for disaster. And if this mass deportation is put forward, then in fact you will see, I think, very strong civil disobedience in this country, because our country will not tolerate this type of a movement. And I think it will be the strongest area of civil disobedience that we've seen since the civil rights movement. And I'd just like to make sure that we erase from the terminology term illegal immigrant. From my perspective, and I think there's plenty of others would agree, those that have a birthright to this nation are the Native Americans. If we're going to apply this terminology of illegal, then we all are illegal. And we need to recognize that, in fact, our country is based on the foundation of accepting immigrants who come here for a variety of reasons, seeking a better way of life for themselves and their families, fleeing from persecution or poverty. And we have a responsibility in our country to support those persons who are productive and are making contributions and helping our country and our society grow. And so I believe that it is our responsibility as citizens to find a way to reform our immigration policy so that we do not have this terminology ever again. And part of the problem with this terminology and those that think about illegals and deportation is that there's a tremendous amount of backlash in that way of thinking. And who gets affected by that type of backlash? Well, there's a significant number of minorities here who are, you know, here legally working or going to school, most notably the Muslim population, that are certainly victims of this type of thinking and backlash. All those that are parts of the gay rights community and advocates of the gay rights community, they are also submitted to this type of backlash and thinking, because this thinking is misogynist, it's racist, it's just inappropriate to our country and our society. And so we need to begin to think about how we can reframe this issue and reframe the situation of the circumstances of over 11 million people in this country so that they can come out of the shadows and further contribute to our country and our society and help us build a stronger nation. And I think that a lot of people would agree with me on that. There, as I said, there is a need for immigration reform. There have been a number of bipartisan efforts from our elected federal officials and have been attempting to pass new immigration laws for over a decade. Let's hope that somehow we can come together as a nation to support immigration reform. It's extremely important. The last substantive immigration reform that I mentioned came from a conservative Republican administration during the time of President Reagan. Ironically, President-elect Trump has an opportunity with control of both the House and the Senate to legislate change on immigration in a positive manner. I hope that the members of the conservative viewpoint that is expressed in this article will remember that we have a responsibility to make all of our residents of our city of Urbana and our country people that have a legitimate means of being represented and have the rights as well as the responsibilities that goes with that proper representation. And I think that I would remind the writer of this article, when this day comes, and it will come, that we will look back and we will remember and we will commemorate the pioneers who supported immigration reform in places like the resolution that was passed for Sanctuary City in Urbana, in Chicago, in L.A., in Seattle. And so we hope that all of these sanctuary cities and the leaders that supported sanctuary cities will be remembered as pioneers in leading the way towards a new day for immigration reform in our country.
And that does it for this week's CU Progressive News. Thank you so much to Lakeisha David and to Ben Mueller for contributing to this episode. We are always looking for members of the community to contribute. If you have any type of progressive organization you would like to talk to us about, if you have any type of issues occurring in the community that you would like to bring to light and have broadcasted, please contact us. You can contact us at weft90.1@gmail.com. We're always open to show ideas. If you would like to help us produce, that would also be very, very welcomed and helpful. Even if it's just like once every 2 months, we will take whatever help we can get. We want more people from the community working on this. The more, the better. We're trying to cover just all the progressive issues happening around East Central Illinois. So thank you to everyone who has listened. If you want to do us a favor, you can tell a friend about CU Progressive News, and maybe they will want to contribute. You know, we're just looking to make the show better in this upcoming year. We're getting better at what we do, but we could definitely use some help. So just thank you to everyone. And we are going to close out this episode with Jesse Worthington. He was one of the first people I interviewed and recorded for CU Progressive News. He is a performer with Speak Cafe, which is on a hiatus right now, but should be coming back to the Cranert Art Museum Cafe around February, and it's just spoken word and singing, and it's fantastic performances, and you can see people like Jesse Worthington there. So here is Jesse Worthington closing out CU Progressive News for 2016. Thank you, everyone.
Well, I'm Jesse Worthington. I hail from this area, Danville, Illinois, to be exact. Right now, I'm going to deliver a John Legend piece called All of Me. Basically, you hear it at a lot of weddings. You hear it at a lot of, commencements and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty much give you all of me. You can sing it to God. You can sing it to your spouse, you know, to your significant other, anything like that. So just a real, you know, not so deep song, but deep enough to where, you know, you can, it makes you think. So definitely.
What would I do without your smart mouth? Drawing me in and you kicking me out. Got my head spinning, no kidding, I can't pin you down. What's going on in that beautiful mind? I'm on your magical mystery ride, and I'm so dizzy, don't know what hit me, but I'll be alright. My head's underwater, but I'm breathing fire. You're crazy now, I'm out of my mind. 'Cause all of me loves all of you. Loves your curves and all your edges. all your perfect imperfections. Give your all to me. Give my all to you. You're my end and my beginning. Even when I'm losing, I'm winning. 'Cause I'll give you all of me, yeah. And you give me all of you, yeah. Oh, give me all of you, boy. Cards on my table, we're both showing hearts, risking it all, though it's hard. 'Cause all of me loves all of you. Love your curves and all your edges, all your perfect imperfections. Give your all to me. Give my all to you. You're my end and my beginning. Even when I lose, I'm winning. I'll give you all of me. You give me all of you. Oh, I give you all of me. And you give me all of you.
I wish I had a better microphone for you.
The Literary Life is produced in association with W.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Paramount Painting. Paramount Painting brings quality interior and exterior painting services to the area with over 20 years of combined experience. They specialize in prep work to ensure the finished product is of exceptional quality. Chris and Dave are family men who enjoy supporting their community. Reach them at ParamountPaintingPlus@gmail.com or at 217-530-1086.
You're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on the FM dial, streaming live at weft.org. I hope you enjoyed the last edition of CU Progressive News for 2016, and we just heard a little clip of Melissa Etheridge's Respect Yourself. Next up is Union Edge, but prior to that, I need to get some underwriting out on the air to you. And also, thanks to all those who contributed to Give Big to My Station. We were able to raise quite a bit of money, but we only got about a third of the way through our goal. So if you go to the weft.org webpage, you will see a link to that if you'd still like to donate to help out your local community radio station. And thanks to all that donated, and thanks in advance to everyone who still will.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Canopy Club, the downstate Illinois home for live music, entertainment, and nightlife. The Canopy Club offers luxury seating and table service for partygoers wanting a VIP experience, as well as general admission tickets. More information is available at canopyclub.com or find them on social media such as Facebook,